say if beta is smaller than all, the Boltzmann factors are small, all the NKs are much less than one, and there's no degeneracy, there's very little multi-population. It's recognized you, okay? Now this is N. And that's equal to V. So we have rho n over b of rho is 1 over c 4 pi pi q k squared dk. So I'm defining kappa we have. All of this is the beta. Kappa squared kappa. You mentioned this wave number. And a prefactor, which is this do I have a kappa is k? So I have to multiply by. So I'll bring this formula up to here to get the important result. And that rho lambda t cubed one over c. I keep all the figures so one knows all the factors so one remembers where they come from. So this is a pure number, and this is a dimensionless number, lambda. I hope I got it on it. Rho is 1 over a length cube, lambda should be 1 over a length. Maybe you got it upside down. To be 1 over a length. Okay? So the physical the physical meaning of lambda then is the mean thermal wavelength of a helium atom. It's from the kinetic energy. The kinetic energy is kT. So the momentum is kT over m. So from that you make the mean thermal wavelength from kT divided by m. Okay. So this is the I forgot. Yeah. And this gives an equation for this parameter G at small temperatures, which is the statement that C is proportional to the amount of stuff that that there are many thermal wavelengths within a distance between the molecules. That's what that statement means. This number is of order one, right? And this is a, we said that C had to be large. C is large, so this is small. So the gas is rare, and there's many thermal wavelengths. This is called the classical phase of the gas.
Mention you made here. Yeah, how come? You approximate the Boltzmann factor by taking the minus one out, but you integrate it over all k. So if k becomes comparable to beta, then this is no longer holds, right?
K. E to the minus k squared over 2m is always less than 1, right?
Yeah.
So up there. And this is equal to e to the minus beta epsilon k 1 minus e to the minus beta epsilon k. This is only much less than one.
Okay, thank you.
This is at k equals zero, this is at most one. C is always large. I forgot to write this. Okay. Now, raise beta. C decreases. Okay, when beta gets larger and larger, then the e to the minus beta, then the e to the beta epsilon k up there gets bigger and bigger. So we have to compensate the exponential increase of e to the beta epsilon k by the corresponding decrease in c in order to keep n fixed. I must say, they're stingy. They want lecturers to write with their fingernails. Okay. So xc decreases, and xc decreases and decreases, and there's no limit to xc decreasing until it hits the value unity, and then it cannot decrease anymore. Because when c becomes less than 1, then the expectation value of n when k is equal to 0 would not be a positive number. So there's a limit on how much we can decrease c. That happens for a special value of t, which I call tc. And tc is given by I have lost, I didn't take my notes this morning, then I have all the notes. I'm trying to reconstruct. Rho. So I put c is equal to 1. So n over v is equal to 4 pi over 2 pi q. How am I doing? K squared dk. So this gives us the equation for TC. This temperature is called the critical temperature. And now before we change the variable, I hope I didn't forget the factors of 2 kappa. And here we have rho lambda c. Q where lambda c is this critical wavelength. So the value of TC corresponds, this is a number, a pure number, some integral, and of order 1. And this means that something very interesting happens when the Compton wavelength becomes comparable to the distance between the particles. And in particular, it means that you don't have enough kinetic energy available to build wave packets which are less than the distance between the particles. So it means that the quantum mechanical wave function of individual particles overlaps each other, and you don't have the sense of individual classical particles anymore. So the quantum effects are being revealed by the existence of this limit t is equal to tc. This is what happens when t is equal to tc. And I'll write this equation in a different way. I is equal to rho lambda q, it's a pure number. Now, for t less than tc, what happens? Well, we have to make an interpretation. And that's what Einstein did. Namely, when you lower the temperature still further, at k is equal to zero, you would encounter this singularity, and you can't handle this thing as an integral anymore. So we say that this singularity is unphysical. We say that there is a number of particles, n zero, whose population is, which is the population of states of k is equal to zero. So we interpret this integral as coming in two parts. N is simply the number of parts. We go back to the original condition that the sum on nk is n. And the k equals zero contribution is the number n zero, and we take it out. And all the rest can be integrated for the excited states. Now, Einstein did this boldly in 1920 or so, and then Fitz London, in a paper in the FISREV sometime in the early 30s, checked it. And he actually did the sum in a box. And then he took the limit that the box goes to infinity, and he proved that the mathematics is okay. So this is not just fairyland, but it's real mathematics. I don't have the reference to London, but it's a nice article where he really does the mathematics of the first 27 levels or whatever. Yeah, he could down the errors. And then the rest. And the number of excited states is this integral, but now not with beta c, but with beta less than beta c, t beta greater than beta c, t less than t c. So this is to the 3. It's a shame I had worked it out carefully last night, and then the snow came. And I panicked about going out, and I forgot my notes. I had it sweetly written, so then we have to figure it out. So let's figure it out. I had a V. Now the cube, so I took out the factor of volume, and I took out this factor to the power 3/2, and then I had the integral I. But I is rho lambda c cubed. V rho is n. So n is equal to n zero. Plus a number less than. Where lambda is mk. Now that I get the, I want t to go smaller and smaller. Did I get this right way or the wrong way? When t. Did I get it upside down?
Lambda is the inverse.
Huh?
Yep.
I got it upside down.
No, the definition of lambda.
Huh?
The definition of lambda.
I've got the definition of lambda wrong.
Right.
Okay. When t gets large, this should get small. As t goes down, the lambda gets bigger. That's right. Okay. So when t goes to zero, this goes to n zero. So when the temperature is zero, all the particles condense into the k equals zero state. But any fool knows that because I have a free gas. The kinetic energy is some on k squared over 2m, and so the ground state, so all particles go into the state k equals 2m. And this statement is that the way you come off the ground state is some number proportional to t over tc. It's 3/2. So it says that at the ground state, all the particles are condensed at t equals zero. You raise t up to tc, and you gradually make excited states, and the density of excited states, there's an n. You gradually make excited, a is a number of order one. You gradually make excited states until you exhaust the reservoir, the condensate of n equals zero, at is equal to tc. And zero is equal to zero. And then you go into the high temperature phase in which you start to introduce the chemical potential C and you have ordinary statistics. So this is called the condensation phenomenon. At T is equal to Tc, there's a finite fraction of the particles that condense into the k equals zero state. And that was quite revolutionary. That was discovered independently by Bose in India and Einstein, wherever he was at that time. And then people weren't very happy with it. And then Linda, not in the London, did this check that their calculations were right when they really did the count. Now, so one had to wait about 30 years until there were further questions asked about the system. In the meantime, there was lots of experiments going on. And the experiments were taking place mostly in Holland, where people discovered the superfluidity, namely these substances were, helium was examined, the properties of helium were examined, they could estimate Tc because they knew the mass of the helium atom. So they did experiments at T less than Tc, and they found very strange phenomena, of which is called superfluidity, for example, a beaker of liquid helium sat at the table at temperatures less than Tc, and it would creep up, the fluid would creep up the side of the beaker and fall down on the other side just spontaneously. Or they took thousands of wires and compressed them into many, many capillaries which were atomic dimension, which would easily have stopped a normal liquid, and the superfluid would just flow through this closely packed assembly of wires. And there were all kinds of phenomena which were called superfluid phenomena. And these are very interesting phenomena, and since then have been investigated in great quantitative detail. And there's a whole folklore which fills textbooks this thick about what the nature of this flow is, and we're not going to go into it in this course. The important point is that there are various mechanisms which characterize and which limit the flow, given that it is a superfluid, given that you have this condensation phenomenon. And for example, as it flows through narrow channels, at tiny microscopic vortexes occur, and this slows the liquid. And there's all kinds of mechanisms of atomic friction which come in, which have received a lot of experimental attention. And that's very important. I'm not going to go into this at all. Otherwise, we would be the whole course on that. But I want to discuss a few things. I want to discuss a problem which fascinates me greatly. If particles interact, and in particular in helium, the particles interact almost with a hardcore interaction, the interatomic potential of liquid helium is repulsive up to a certain distance, and then there's a little attractive tail which would modify the wave function only in a small perturbative way, but the general allure of the wave function would be determined simply by the exclusion of helium atoms from the volumes which they occupy. And so one can make progress in estimating how much of the atoms in liquid helium really do condense, given the model that it's essentially a hardcore gas. Is it 90%? Is it 2%? It could be anything. So you can make a gamble. How do you guess? And then this guy Anzager is so smart that he was able to, with Oliver Penrose, make an estimate of the percentage of helium atoms that in fact do condense. And the way it's done, what a shame that I don't have my note, because I didn't look at these notes. I'm going to, so how many atoms condense? At T equals 0. That's the subject. I'm just going to limit myself to the ground state properties. If the ideal gas 100% condenses, now I have notation. This is the ground state and medium atoms. And in the second quantization, I introduce a second quantized field, psi of r, as I do in field theory. Psi of r is an operator that annihilates a quantum of field, an amplitude of field at r, normalized such that the commutator of psi star psi is delta of r minus r prime. It's a delta function normalization. So it's the conventional field theoretic norm of a Bose-Einstein field. And I build a component in second quantization of the ground state wave function by just creating n atoms in a volume V through these Bose creation operators. And the complete ground state is obtained by giving the weight of one of these configurations. I could put a particle here, I put a particle there, put a particle there, I put a particle there, and so on. Then I have to give a weight. This weight is called the first quantized wave function. It's a symmetrized a function of all the r's. And the complete state is obtained by the superposition of all the configurations weighted correctly with the amplitude to find some one of them. So that's how second quantized quantum mechanics works. I hope that you have been exposed to. Normally, you use second quantization in field theory, but it's equally applicable in the matter physics, and it's a big convenience. Okay? So that is the state. From this state, you build a single particle density matrix the way you do it. Oh, what a shame, I forgot my notes, because I had it all so clear last night. And I always forget. So the single particle density matrix is the construction which answers the question, if I take the state and set the quantized notation, and on that state I create a particle here, what is the amplitude of finding some evidence of its existence there? Okay. And now, in an ordinary system, if I go far enough away, say in the gas in this room, if I create a particle here, I will find no evidence that I have done that act sufficiently far away. There's been a readjustment of the molecule, and so on. For a system where there's condensation, where the wave function can have a long wavelength component, and in particular, that's what we are investigating, because we want to know if this wave function shows signs of having zero momentum single particles in them, then the influence will be felt at the level of the volume itself. So far, far away, the difference between a Bose-Einstein condensed system, no matter how complicated it is, and a non-Bose-Einstein condensed system is in the asymptotic limit of large separation, that thing is zero or non-zero.
It's a brain to think about.
And that brain is on target. Now, if you write out what that is, well, there's a few things to say. Let me put this. We haven't given this a name yet. So this is an interesting construction to test whether there's a Bose-Einstein condensation. Let's work in the bulk. Where the translation is. So way far from the edges, whether I look the system there or there, if the edges are way far away, I have translational symmetry. Then the eigenfunctions can be classed by the momentum. Or if you like, I can take the system with periodic boundary conditions. This is the standard way to work with the macroscopic systems in many body systems or in field theory. Then if I look at rho, and I expand it, well, first of all, I take the field, and then and naturally, and study it momentum component by momentum component, because the good eigenfunctions in the bulk are the momentum single particle functions. And I examine rho with a complete set of states. So I just insert a complete set of states. I'm in the bulk. So the ground state of the system is going to be translationally symmetric, and that's going to outwork in the rest frame. So this is going to be a total momentum zero. And therefore, the intermediate states n, operating on a state of total momentum zero, have created a quantum of momentum k prime. So these states have momenta, which are indeed obtained by the label of the annihilation or creation operators I've used to make these intermediate states. So this state has momentum k prime. And this state has momentum k prime, because it's the same. But it also has momentum k, because it's a complex conjugate the other way around. So I conclude that k is equal to k prime. Another way to say it is, are you okay with that argument? Let's just say it again. Another way to say it is, if the whole thing has a translational symmetry in the bulk, then rho of r prime can depend only on r minus r prime. So if I add a constant vector to both r and r prime, I should do nothing, because that means that the single particle density matrix there would be the same as the single particle matrix there. And that's what characterizes the bulk. So if I add a constant A to both R prime and R, that would induce a non-trivial phase, e to the I k prime minus k dot A. But that should be 1, so k is equal to k prime. So there are two ways to think about why k is equal to k prime. So in the bulk, this is equal to I want it to be. I want it to be the other way around. I'm sorry. The story is, I saw the ice and I was afraid to walk. So I called the taxi because I didn't want to walk to the bus stop. And so I rushed out. I left the notes I had carefully prepared. Let's just simplify the notation. And then I could just did one half to drag and then A plus one there, which is like I could change the order of annihilation. Now, well, that's interesting. The single particle density matrix as a function of R minus R prime is the Fourier transform of the number density population as a function of momentum. That's a cute result. Namely, when I put a particle there and I get the response there, if I know the distribution in momentum of the single particles in the fluid, that tells me how much the influence at R prime will be when I add an order, add or subtract the particle at R. A very unsuspected kind of quantum mechanics, and not very intuitive, and very beautiful. And what we learn is that first of all, let me do the simple thing. That the diagonal element is simply the number of particles in the system. Now that depends a little bit on the norm that I use, and the disadvantage of my not having my notes, which I did last night, was I worked out carefully the normalization conventions which I required. Namely, sometimes the AK carries a 1 over the square root of the volume. In this case, this would be the density. Sometimes the AK would carry a 1 over the square root of n, in which case this would be 1, and so on. And so I just have to play it by ear. I didn't know what the answer should be. And the answer which I'm going to give you is the answer you have to follow if you're consistent with the normalizations. But main physical ideas will be there. And the other thing is, when the R and the R prime go far apart, and then let's look here. And this is the number of condensed particles. That's the number of excited particles. Now, this part of it bears the momentum of the excited particles, and hence in the bulk something which oscillates up and down, and if R minus R prime goes to infinity, this part of it will have some kind of a destructive interference, and when I integrate that over all K, you do expect and you check that the integral from k equals 0, not including k equals 0, but in the open set from k equals 0 to infinity is an integral which is proportional to 1 over the correlation length of the particles in the fluid, It's roughly 1 over the density, 1 over the cubed of the, 1 over the cubed root of the density. The wave functions go like this, and the rate of variations goes like the, how it has to vary to accommodate the existence of the particles. So this quantity for asymptotically large r minus r prime goes to 0, roughly like 1 over the distance between the particles. And you're left with this. Thus, if you have and I'm going to write this in this peculiar form, and I remember some years ago I went to a meeting. I had been out of this field for a long time. It was a meeting of people who were interested in many body systems and field theory at the same time, and people were talking about what was the wave function, about the wave function of liquid helium, and I simply did not know what they were talking about. Because it wasn't this guy, it wasn't that many body wave function. It was just something that they drew on the blackboard. And they said that when helium flowed, then you induced the gradient of the wave function of liquid helium. And so I asked people what they meant, what wave function of helium, but nobody could explain to me mathematically. And then I understood, after I read up a little on the subject, that what they were talking about was that when particles are well separated, the concept of an independent particle wave function arises. If I didn't have a homogeneous system, you would still have a non-vanishing asymptotic value, and it would factorize into some single particle wave function, A0 of r times A0 of r prime, with some phase difference between them, with an amplitude equal to the square root of N0, but with the phase difference between them. And that phase difference would encode the superfluid flow, the gradient of the phase between r and r minus r prime. And that was the basis, that's the basis of the whole phenomenology of the study of superfluid flow. So this Anzaga paper sets the scene for that. And people might have told that to me, or maybe they didn't understand it. However, I'm not going into that subject because I chose to work in the bulk and the translationally symmetric medium so that the phases don't change from point to point. I'm working in the flowless approximation because I don't want to spend an undue amount of time on the subject. But if I wanted to, I could then, from this point, start to consider an R dependence here and an R prime dependence there, and that would be the superfluid wave function. That's how it gets introduced into the formalism. Okay? But whatever the essential lesson is there, that Einstein condensation is the phenomenon which in many body systems is able to carry the message from here to there, where that's the macroscopic distance. And that's really essential. The essential feature of what Bose-Einstein condensation is. And now I want to show you how these clever guys were able to calculate the amplitude. They were able to calculate that in an approximation, but to give you the feeling for it. So we want to come off of this, right? We no longer want n0 to be 0 when t is equal to 0. n0 to be n when t is equal to 0. We want 10% of that, or 20% of that. And we want to know how to calculate that 10%. We know it can't be 100%. It can't be 100% because a picture of the wave function, a picture of the wave function is that if I have a particle here and there's another particle there, then the wave function has to bend, it has to curve, because it can't hit this guy. So in a single particle picture, this must have some sense of a wave packet with finite momentum wave numbers in order to exclude its overlap into its neighbors because it's repelled from its neighbors. So we know that the number can't be 100% condensed. And what we want to do is we want to quantify that thought. The expression, you take the second quantized form, and we've expressed it. Up there, and we perform the operation of extracting from the second quantized form the single particle density matrix in the form that contains the amplitude, the first quantized amplitude psi, and then you just turn the crank with the annihilation and creation operators, using the fact of psi and dagger psi, psi dagger r psi of r is norm to a delta function and integrating. And what you get is hardly surprising. And in some texts, this is the starting point, namely using first quantization. What name did I get? I hold R and R prime fixed. I stick in two operators which depend only on R and R prime, the two special coordinates, and all the others are integrated against, which gives me these delta functions, R2 minus R2 prime, R3 minus R2 prime, which puts all these coordinates together, and that results in this expression. So another way to think of the single particle density matrix is in first quantization. You have the first quantized wave function, the symmetrized product. You make the overlap between them, but you keep two points distinct, R and R prime, and then you integrate over all the others. And that formula is equivalent to the second quantized formula, which I find conceptually more convenient to seize in the first place. And that's because when one works in field theories, one is used to that. Now the cleverness. For something like liquid helium, where you have this a strong repulsive potential, the atoms keep each other out of their way, so the amplitude should be zero when the particles overlap, and we'll put the amplitude equal to one otherwise. not quite right, because there'll be little structure on the other side of the hard core potential because of the subtraction. But that we would suppose is a perturbative calculation to be placed on top of this one afterwards. And therefore, we stick in an exclusion factor. The wave function is a constant outside of a radius and zero inside of the radius. And that just prevents them from overlapping. Okay? And that's the approximation. That means. It has the convenient algebraic simplification that omega squared is equal to omega. Now I call your attention to the fact that this is the partition function of a classical gas, the configurational partition function. There's the part due to the kinetic energy. It's the configurational partition function of a classical gas of hard spheres. That is the partition function. The classical partition function is pi dp dq e to the minus h pq. Okay, these are the momenta, these are the coordinates. This is a Hamiltonian of an n-body system, the function of their momenta coordinates. H is the sum of the two in the classical physics. In classical physics, they factorize, because there's no commutative problem. This is classical. So this part is the partition function due to the kinetic energy. This part is what I call the configuration of partition function. And that's the figure. Remember, I see some puzzles. V is the sum of the potential energy. So V is the sum of n times n minus 1 over 2 pairs, where each pair is a potential energy which is zero when the particles don't touch, and infinity, plus infinity, when the particles do penetrate. So this n times n minus 1 over 2 fold product is the product of all these exclusion pairs, which is 1 or 0. Therefore, this statement. Okay. So, this is what I'm using. This size for the whole many body weight function norms to unity. The psi is simply the product of the exclusion factors with a normalization factor, which is this configuration of a classical wave function. Since, as I've just shown, the integral of the pi omega ij is the cube, and omega squared is equal to 1. Remember. From whence? I use that. I use this, and I use this to get. And I factor out the special exclusion factors since I have the R and the R prime here. One of them involves a psi of r and all the rest, and the other psi r prime of all of the rest. And in that product, I must make sure that the special one r does not overlap with the rest, nor r prime overlap with the rest. So now you see that when r is equal to r prime, because omega squared is equal to 1, this coalesces into the single exclusion factor that r or r prime, because they're the same when r is equal to r prime. This overlaps to the exclusion factor, and this numerator then collapse is in the precise word itself, and that guarantees the norm, and that the integral of the precise word is equal to 1. Remember, I wrote the that, and I told you I wasn't sure whether it was 1 or n or what happened. That I figured out last night, but I don't know how I did it. But that doesn't matter. That's the detail. It shows you that the whole thing, when r prime is equal to r, it recovers the conventional normalization, whichever convention you use. But when r is equal to, not equal to r prime, it's not the same. In fact, when r is not equal to r prime, I invite you to consider a system of n plus 1 particles, where the coordinate of the nth is r, and the coordinate of the n plus first is r prime. And then this numerator must be considered the multi-distribution function of n plus 1 particles, which exclude each other. So in the single particle density matrix, when r is not equal to r prime, the integrand has the interpretation of the classical multi-particle n plus 1 gas system. I've switched over from the n particle system to the n plus 1 particle system. And then I would say that this is the two particle distribution to find r and r prime in the n plus 1 particle system, where the positions of the nth and the n plus first are r and r prime. So it would be a function of a row of r and r prime. If I fix r in the n plus 1 particle system here and r prime in the n plus 1 particle there, it would be the simultaneous density to find r there and r prime there. All the others swimming around because I integrate on the position of all the others. And that would be the correct interpretation if it would have the proper norm to be identified with the density. Well, to have a proper norm to be identified with the density, I would divide this by the partition function of the n plus 1 particle system. And then this would truly be the proportional to the two particle distribution at r and r prime in the n plus 1 particle system. And so I stick in a qn plus 1 down here in order to make this interpretation here. And I compensate for that multiplication by putting it here. So I have learned that the two-particle quantum mechanical distribution function of the n boson gas is proportional to the two-particle a distribution function in the gas with n plus 1 particles through this construction with proper norm by this device. One sometimes has the impression of the infinite cuteness of clever physicists. This is just infinite cuteness. How to think of these things. Now, in the limit, as r minus r prime goes to infinity in a gas like that, if I put a particle there and I ask what is the distribution of another particle far away? It goes to the ambient density. This is the classical physics. So in the asymptotic limit, when R gets infinitely far away to R prime, this thing goes, this factor, as complicated as it looks, goes to the ambient density.
N over V.
Or N plus 1 over V, that's the same. So the two particle distribution of this system is simply go to the constant, which is the density. So, and this is a constant. And I've got my norms all mixed up, and they're on my paper at home. And next time I'll bring it in. I don't want to take time to figure it all out. But it's essentially the ambient density rho. And then you have to believe me that the normalization constants work out. And I think that. So I just have to beg your pardon for this lapse, and that I got some. And there are some details that have to be filled in on normalization. But the net result is we had proven that this thing is proportional to N0. And if you're careful with the normalization factors, you get an N0 over N here. And you get a 1 over V here. And you get 2. Oh. Yeah, I think I can even dope it out. I think I can even dope it out from here. We had proven that in the asymptotic limit, this thing goes to N0. Here is the constant factor Qn plus N over Qn. In the asymptotic limit, this is a two-particle distribution as R prime goes infinitely far from R. So this goes to the ambient density. So here is the ambient density. So this formula is this formula. And now I'll write it out on a separate sheet, so that all the logical normalizations are there. It's only messing around with the definitions of the normalization. But this is the answer. And you see the beautiful sense that it makes. It tells you that the fraction of condensed particles is the ratio of two volumes. This has the dimension volume to the power n plus 1. Being an n plus 1 fold integral. This has the dimension of the volume of n particles. So this has the dimensions of a volume. So what we find is that the fraction of condensed particles is the ratio of the volume that comes up in this ratio to the total volume. Why? Because the volume, intuitively, because the volume of the n-particle gas which appears in these integrals is the volume for which these omega factors are unity and not zero. So I give a name for the volume which is accessible in the hardcore partition function. I call this the free volume. It's the amount of volume available to a particle as it swims. It's that part of the volume which is not in the hardcore system. So this is something like the free volume to the power n plus 1 divided by the free volume to the power n.
If you subtract it to room, that's the particles taken?
And that's the definition. And that's mathematics. It's dimensionally correct. Mm-hmm. It surely is zero if all the space is filled with impenetrable matter. Mm-hmm. And it surely is the total volume if none of the space is filled with impenetrable matter. So something between them. And I give it the name free volume. And I have an intuition for it. Namely, if I have a hard sphere there and a hard sphere there, then it's the amount, then it's something per particle which relates to the amount of space between them. So it gives me the idea of how much of the wave function, the single particle wave function between these two spheres can be not curved, because in between them, you see, if they were very close, would come back right away and you wouldn't have any cable zero component. So it gives me the sense of how much cable zero component per particle can be squeezed between the spheres. So I give it the name free volume for three reasons, or for four reasons. It's dimensionally correct. It has the correct asymptotic behavior extending from zero to V in the two extreme circumstances. And furthermore, it has the intuition of what you want, namely the amount of volume between two spheres that can support a K equals zero wave function. Can't do better. The mathematics is this. But I like the definition because I like the sense.
Okay.
And as I say, for me it's infinitely cute. It really is one of the cutest things I know in law of physics to think that. But to think in these terms is amazing. And of course, what does it mean? It means that the guy is steeped in the culture. He knows quantum mechanics, he knows statistical mechanics, he thinks geometrically, he's just a complete scientist. And it comes up time and time again about that, yeah. The way he did the Ising model, for example, the way he did the two-dimensional vector model. Also fabulous. Just one of these great geniuses. So that's a nice result. And essentially, it's good to know that the notion of condensation is not limited to just free field theory, like I did for the spin waves, where we were at a low temperature, and then we had essentially a free gas of spins, without taking much into account the interaction of the excitations. If this is an example where you have these beta freedom which are interacting, and nevertheless, there emerges from the analysis the sense of a condensation. So condensation has a broader connotation than one might have thought just from the term I get at the example, which is why I emphasize this lesson. Okay, now the next thing to do in this chapter is to show you what another genius does with it. He's named Bogoliubov. And to show you that this is an example of spontaneous broken symmetry in the sense that this analysis still goes through, and I consider this A0 to be a condensate wave function, and that there will be no harm if to A0 I attach a phase, and to the A0 dagger, which appears on the other side, I attach another phase, e to the I0, phi minus phi prime. And I pick up, I can pick up these phases at intermediate stages, in fact. But I won't do that. But all I want to emphasize here is that for the moment, give me a break. Let me attach a phase A0 e to the I phi. Let me give this a phase. We know that the phase of a wave function has no meaning. It's always the relative phase. So this is really, if I put a phase here and another phase here, it's really e to the I phi of r, e to the I phi of r prime, which are constants as r and r prime vary when r minus r prime is large. But to make believe that the system in this region, in this asymptotic region, carries this phase a0 e to the I phi. And I'm breaking the symmetry because when I multiply each creation operator and each annihilation operator in the Hamiltonian by phi, n is conserved. The fact that n is conserved means that the Hamiltonian carries as many creation operators as it does annihilation operators. So if each creation operator and each annihilation operator is multiplied by e to the plus or minus I phi, according to whether it be a creator or an annihilator, the Hamiltonian is invariant under that phase transformation. So an invariance of this Hamiltonian is a gauge invariant of the first kind, against the phase transformation that the second quantized field psi, which I've introduced, is transformed to psi e to the I phi, where phi is the same phi for all of the single particle operators. That is a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. And now if I decide that it's a convenience, suppose I have helium here, and suppose I have helium here, and there's flow. But in this region, the flow is constant and it's one thing. And in this region, the flow is constant in another way. And there's a slow transmission of the flow between them. When I describe the dynamics in this region, I have the phase corresponding to that flow. Here, when I describe it in the phase corresponding to this flow, and I do my dynamics here, for example, I calculate the specific heat per unit volume here. or the specific heat per unit volume. They're going to be the same. And you're not going to tell me that just because I tacked on a phase e to the I phi to the operators there, and that I'm going to change the thermodynamics there. It's the same as if I have a ferromagnet and I have a condensed phase, and I go to the limit of a zero magnetic field, I'm stuck with an arrow, but I work out all the thermodynamics and I find that the specific heat is proportional to the specific heat due to the spin waves, which is t to the 3/2 or whatever it is. That's not going to depend on the direction of that spontaneous magnetization. That's independent of the magnetization. The proof of that is that the Hamiltonian is rotationally invariant. That I did not do when I did the spin wave stuff, because I didn't have enough time to do everything. But you can do it. And in the same way, I worked out the thermodynamics here with a fixed value of A0. And that's what Bugger-Yubov did. Now, Bugger-Yubov did that before Anzaga. It's an amusing incident in my life, because I was in Brussels. I didn't know Russian, but I had the habit of going to the library every morning and see what came in. In those days, there were machines. And I also scanned what was in the Russian journals. So I saw this article by Yubov in Russian, but I saw the equations. So it's an example in which I read a complete paper from A to Z without a single word. It's just going from equation to equation. And I was astonished. It was so beautiful. And then after this was in 1954 or so. And then after that, we got spoiled, and the Russian journals became translated into English. And now they write in English anyway. Okay. And what was Bugger-Yubov's? And what was Bugger-Yubov's idea? Bugger-Yubov's idea was, he didn't need Anzaga to twist his arm. And let me assume that it's a finite fraction, which is condensed. Just assume it. And then he said, if I look at the Hamiltonian, interaction Hamiltonian, these are these are symbols that the KI numbers, I means KI. Okay, so in this Hamiltonian appears various processes. You can have with the appropriate might as well. Let me do it this way. It's so deep. so it tells a story. These things have four A zeros. These things have two A zeros. There are in between here and nothing. With three A zeros. And you can't have free zero momentum particles making a finite momentum particle. Here's another neat one. Did I get them all right? An emission conjugate. These are all the terms with two A zeros.
Should the A dagger be on the second? Should be A dagger K, A dagger zero.
Okay, I don't want that one.
Yeah.
Thanks.
And the second one.
Right, if that here. Yeah. That's right. Absolutely right. Right. Okay. And then it keeps on going. Now, but you have said that the really important phenomenon which is occurring in condensed bosonic systems was the condensation phenomenon. And so let's investigate firstly the leading terms would come about because there exists a condenser. So he begins by just writing down the minimal number of terms in the Hamiltonian which contain the minimal number of A zeros. They can be four, and the maximum number of A zeros. Contain four A zeros. Or two A zeros. And they contain the A zeros in two different ways. It contains A zero, A zero dagger, or A zero, A zero. And then he says, after I solve that problem, and then I can start to look at the terms with one A zero. In which particles of three different momenta combine to make a particle of zero momentum, and terms with four non-A zero terms. And he says this I can take care of afterwards in a perturbative way. And people spent, of course, a long time doing that once they get the idea. But he squeezed an awful lot out of this approximation. And now comes the extremely interesting remark, which is concerned with bosonic condensation and spontaneous breakdown of symmetry. As written, the retained Hamiltonian still contains the fundamental gauge symmetry of the problem. If each annihilation and creation operator is multiplied by a common phase, to the I phi to the minus I phi, according to whether it be an annihilator or a creator. This part of the Hamiltonian retains its symmetry. The basic symmetry of the problem, the symmetry which gives us a result that the number of particles is conserved. Just as in the ferromagnet, the basic symmetry was rotational symmetry. It gives you the conservation of angular momentum. Here it gives you the conservation of the number of particles. It's convenient, in fact, often to think in terms of analogies where the number of particles is equated to the Z component of an angular momentum problem. Well, you know, often when you quantize angular momentum, Schwinger's method of quantization of angular momentum writes the spin operators as pair operators or second quantized operators. It's often a convenience to go back and forth between the two languages. Now comes Mr. Bugyubo and says, sure, I got symmetry. But look, I want to calculate a quantitative result. And I know that if I have a macroscopic number of particles condensed in the ground state, and I calculate the matrix element of a process in which I go from N0 to N0 plus 1 or N0 minus 1 by one of these scattering processes. So sometimes I'm going to have a square root of N0 plus 1, sometimes a square root of N0 minus 1, sometimes just a square root of N0, as I have here. Here, as you said, I would just have the square root of N0. Here I would have an N0 plus 2, or an N0 plus 1 times an N0 plus 2, and so on. But the square root of N0 is 10 to the 23. The square root of 10 to the 23 is 10 to the 10 or 10 to the 11. So we do no injustice to the physics, says he, in a qualitative sense. If I consider the A0C numbers equal to the square root of N0, and I just look at the excitations, when I do that philosophically, what I've done is I've taken a second quantized system with a condenser, and I've converted the k equals 0 component of the wave function to a lifeless reservoir. If I make a pair of particles, I only consider a conservation of momentum sacred. So I can make a pair of excited particles, but their total momentum is zero. But this lifeless reservoir, it can give a zero momentum, and that's all it gives. It doesn't respond quantum mechanically. You don't have to keep track of the phases, because I expect to make a quantitative error in the physics and the dynamics which I will perform to be negligible, because I'm simply replacing matrix elements by other matrix elements which differ from them by something which is negligible in the thermodynamic limit, given that the number of condensed particles is a macroscopic number. So that's Bugyubov's essential approximation. And then he worked out the result. Well, but to work out the result of that is very easy. Once you say that, you have this quadratic form. And this is a number, so this is constant. And then you have a quadratic form containing AK dagger AK, and a quadratic form A minus K AK, and It's a Mishin conjugate. And then I say, if I have a quadratic form which contains AA, which contains AA dagger, A dagger A, AA, and A dagger A dagger, then there's going to be a linear combination of A and A dagger, which is going to diagonalize that form. Any linear combination, I only have these three kinds of quadratic forms, A dagger A, and A dagger A dagger. So there's going to be some linear combination of A and A dagger, which will, say, alpha, which will be of the form alpha, alpha dagger. And the terms which would come up, which would be proportional to alpha dagger, or alpha, alpha, I set equal to zero. The process of setting these unwanted terms, alpha dagger, or alpha, alpha, equal to zero, is called diagonalizing that Hamiltonian matrix. That's what we do when we diagonalize a harmonic oscillator, when we have a P and a Q. A P and a Q is an A plus an A dagger and an A minus A dagger. And we come up terms, we put them together, we scramble them. We have AA, A dagger, A dagger, and AA dagger. And then we put to zero, if you go through your early quantum mechanics, to see what we do if we put the terms in A, and A dagger equal to zero, and we have a diagonal thing in A dagger A. So we're just doing conventional quantum mechanics. Right? So, I have a couple of questions to
your microphone about that.
So, anyway, you don't need this thing.
Sorry.
No. So I'll write down the Hamiltonian, which you get by this process. And what diagonalizes it. And that will be the end of Bose-Einstein condensation, so we can go into superconductivity next time. Because remember, we're halfway done, and I want to get the superconductivity, and I want to get gauge theory. And I want to get spontaneous spiral rates. So I have to do things. But to give you the ideas, I'm going to give you the schematic calculations. Kinetic energy.
this is the bare kinetic energy. This is the term in which there is an interaction of the excited particles. Here it is. The excited particles, the interaction makes a K and then it annihilates. So it's proportional to NK. And at the same time, there's a passive A0, a dagger A0 proportional to N0. So I think that's this. And this approximation in atomic physics is called Hartree-Fock approximation. It's the approximation in which a certain number of degrees of freedom are treated passively without any reaction to the things which are reacting with them. For example, in an atom, you have an S state as an outer shell, and you have all the inner shells, and you just treat all the inner shells as a passive lump. And it's the potential of the inner shells in which the outer shells move, which governs the dynamics. Think of the inner shells as the condenser, and these are the outer shells. So this is Hartree-Fock approximation. And you notice that it has a gap. It, of course, the energy of excitation then would be proportional to the number of excited particles times Vn0, where V is the potential. And I didn't write the momentum components of the V. I'm interested in NK very small, so I can neglect the momentum dependence of the V. And then there's the other thing which is novel. That's these guys. And what the approximation is to replace the N0 plus or minus 1s by N0s. So to treat the reservoir as a condensate, as a passive condensate. We did something very similar in spin wave theory. And when I developed the elementary excitations and I looked at the equation of motion for the SI plus or minus, and when I looked at the spin waves, we had the SK. But then there was one term which was S0 at K is equal to 0, SZ at K is equal to 0. And what did I do? What did I do? I replace SZ at K equals 0 by 1, always spin more up. But that was my choice of that ground state. I could have begun with another ground state and done the same thing, and so on. It was my choice, and I could do it, and I availed myself of the symmetry of the Hamiltonian to do it, and the validity of the approximation is obvious. This is the analog of writing SZ at K is equal to 0 equal to a C number. This one. So this just record that. This is Hartree-Fock's theory. So this is subtle. This is new. This is a 1930 physics. This is 1960 physics. And now that they analyze it, and that's a cinch. And anybody can diagonalize it for that. Not that anybody could have done that. That takes genius. I just had a limited window. I think I wrote up something last night. Nice, neat notes. So that AK to the unitary transformation. I'll explain this right away. A minus K is the same. And it's a simplification to put theta k, you put the quantum state at minus state. You may confirm, because of these factors, that AK prime obey conventional Bose commutation relations. And that's why I call this a unitary transformation, because if I take a state AK, or an AK dagger operating on vacuum, okay?
Yeah, sure.
If I take a state AK dagger operating on a vacuum containing one particle in flux space, the alpha case, because of these commutation relations, it will also give me a vacuum such that they excite the vacuum to give me one extra particle in flux space. One extra space. So this is a unitary transformation. And now I stick this in. Parker's cookbook. Put to zero the non-diagonal terms, extract the diagonal terms, and get a condition. And then the cross state is the theta k is what it is, from 1 minus the square root of sin. And the diagonal form that remains is there you have it. So we solved the problem. The elementary excitations are bosons. Their physical sense is that they are linear combinations of annihilation and creation operators of particles, therefore quasi-particles. And the process is that, unlike the original particles, who feel the potential in a passive Hartree-Fock way, which I mentioned, they come about because as they propagate through the reservoir, they feel the reservoir in the passive Hartree-Fock way through the N0B term. And they combine in pairs, and they go and they get swallowed up by the reservoir, and they get lost. And the reservoir spits out another pair, and they go in a different way. And you build up finite momentum excitations by pairs in that way. So it's a tricky way in which the particles are constantly interchanging with the reservoir particles to propagate through the medium. And the energy of that propagating wave, a finite momentum k, comprised of two particles in this way, is this thing which has the interest that the Hartree-Fock energy it drops out. The term which is proportional to N0B squared drops out. So that the small k, when you expand this, you have a term in epsilon k squared here, which is k4, plus a linear term in epsilon k times N0B, the N0B squared drops out. So for small k, it's proportional to CK. So this process of propagation through the reservoir with the constant exchange between reservoir particles and excited particles in this way at small k is an acoustic way whose dispersion relation is proportional to a sound velocity times momentum. And if you look at the weights for small k, if the time is up and more than up, if you look at the linear combination of the weights for small k, then you find that if k goes to zero, that the alphas contain equal weights of ak and minus k, ak and a minus k dagger. And then you go into the physics of what equal weights of AK and A minus K dagger mean, and you express this in terms of configuration space for how you express a density wave, a rho of R, of K as it goes through the fluid, and you find that it's of that form. So you confirm the identification by examining these coefficients. You will confirm the identification of this with an acoustic way in which the excitations corresponds to density fluctuations. I don't know why, nor do I appreciate why spontaneous broken symmetry lenses. Oh yeah, I guess I do. It must be related, I have to go into it. It must be related to the fact that the gauge symmetry is related to the conservation of the number of particles. And therefore, the long wavelength excitations give you small fluctuations in the conservation of the particles. I should go into this in more detail. And I think there is an intimate relation between the gauge group and the phonon character of the spectrum, which is the oscillation of the density. But it really is an oscillation of the physical density. The physical density really oscillates like in a sound wave. And now, helium is a little bit too complicated because the approximations I've made would be, if the vehicle constants are a bit too rough. But now the experiments are done for Bose-Einstein gases in Scandinavia somewhere. And then they confirm all the details. Okay. So that's the end of Bose-Einstein system. And next time we pick up superconductors.